Hello and welcome to the Global Expressions Podcast. We are your co-hosts, Elda and Leo. I'm Leo. I'm a senior econ and film double major, and I'm class of 2026.
Hi, I'm Elda. I'm a neuroscience major, and I'm class of 2029 from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Professor, please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Carmen Valdivia, and I'm assistant professor in the program of Spanish at the Languages and Literary Studies Department.
Thank you for joining Leo and I today on this episode of Global Expressions Podcast. So I'll get into the question, and I think the first question is, can you tell us a little bit more about your educational journey, and how did you come to work at Lafayette College?
Thank you for having me, Elda and Leo, for inviting me to the Global Expressions series. It's a long answer, but I'll try to summarize. So this is my third year at Lafayette. Before Lafayette, I was at McAllister College in Minnesota. And before that, I was at UC Davis finishing my PhD in California. And before that, I was living in California. So when I saw your invitation, the first thing that comes to mind is like, I'm such a non-traditional academic educator. Like when I hear other stories or other professors' CVs, like there is this pattern of continuity, right? But when you are an international student, when you're an immigrant, what appears on a CV as a gap or what happened here, there are so many explanations. So in relation to that, I came to the US not as a student. I came to work with a temporary visa in 2002, and my goal was to work, save money, and return to my country, which is Peru. Life had other plans for me. Some family circumstances forced me to overstay my visa. And so I became undocumented, and I was undocumented for many years. That meant a language barrier, although I already spoke some English, but it was not enough for being in the US and not knowing the educational system. So it was figuring out my life, like as on the go, like if I learning to fly, like on the spot.
Yeah.
So it took me a while to understand the educational system, which is very different to Peru. I was at the community college for many years. Then somebody told me, if you have a degree in Peru, you can. What is the word? You can make it work here, like validate it. And then, so I decided, okay, I have a degree in administration, tourism administration. So I decided to use my language skills and began my master's in Spanish and literary studies. At the same time, I got married, had a child, and somebody told me, you should do a PhD. And I was like, yeah, sure, let's do a PhD. Again, as an immigrant, not knowing what I was getting myself into. It was hard. It took me another 9 years to finish my PhD and a lot of changes in my life. And so that's the answer. That's how I got to Lafayette 3 years ago.
Thank you so much. And it's great to hear that kind of story as well, because my family as well kind of experienced the same thing. They're from Mexico as well. So thank you. And our next question is going to be about your research. So your research integrates racial, indigenous, and feminist critiques to analyze contemporary Latin American cultural production, particularly the representation of indigenous women in the Andean region. So how did you first develop an interest in this field? And how do conversations about indigenous cultural production and representation differ between the United States and Peru or other Latin American contexts?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question, and is tightly related to the first question and how we find our path, each one of us, with little or more information sometimes. Like you say, Leo, your family, when your family is an immigrant, they have lots of gaps of information. So when I started doing my PhD, identity, culture, language, race, it was at the core of all the big questions I wanted to answer. Like, okay, now I'm in this country. Why so different? Why the things I used to have in Peru, I don't have it anymore? And it has to do with privilege and race. Again, race, we know in this country, race traverses everything. So in Peru, and this goes to the last part of the question, why is so different in the US and in Peru, and we could say Latin America, race and ethnicity are concepts that work in similar ways sometimes, but are also very different. Some scholars would say race in Latin America is more fluid. You can be this and this and this, compared to in the US, you are this or this, right? Like it's more strict, and it has to do with official discourses and institutions that are historically formed or thought to separate here, right? To categorize and segregate. Peru and Latin America has a different historical evolution, although that word is bias, a different process. You can be mestizo, like we are mixed of mixed race, and you can be, when it comes to my research, you can be closer to being indigenous, or you can, through some means, distance yourself from indigeneity. And then you add gender to that, and it gets more complicated. So when I started doing my PhD, I saw the situation of indigenous women, why they don't appear on television, why they don't appear on magazines, why we don't have political representatives in Congress, and why people make fun of them, why there are so many stereotypes. And back then, between 1980 and 2000, Peru went through a political armed conflict in which almost 70,000 people were disappeared or killed, and three quarters of those were indigenous people from Quechua communities. So it was very specific, right, who was affected by the violence. And violence also had a gender dimension. Indigenous women were sexually abused, harassed, and the government also forcibly sterilized over 300,000 women without their consent. So all this, when I began my research, all this was kind of loose. Like, why do we have these patterns of lack of representation in media parallel to lack of representation in politics? Well, now that it's been years that I'm doing my research, they go hand in hand. Like, if you have access to media, to resources, to language, to education, then you have more chances to make yourself heard, to make yourself visible. So that's where I find myself now, like almost 10 years later. Now young women, young Quechua women, are using social media to subvert all of this. Stereotypes, misrepresentations, and they are doing it with like social media, with videos, YouTube, TikTok, Instagram. So they are using the resources that are available to them, because political space is still not fully available. There are some spaces, but not fully yet.
Thank you.
I saw that like your research is very interdisciplinary in nature, and you also talked about how you came about in the US. So I think the next question is, what was the culture shock you'd say that you went to when you first came to the US? And what was like the hardest thing that you needed to adjust to after coming here?
Oh, thank you, Elsa. That's a great question. I think the key word interdisciplinary is because you're trying to grasp from different parts. Like I have that picture more clear in my head too. Like, yeah, I didn't have all the information that someone who, for example, studied anthropology or sociology and follow this clear path to research, right? I was like in the middle of it. Okay, what do I do with all this information and my own experience? And I think it's very common when I see scholarship by Black and Indigenous people, the methodologies are more diverse, more rich, or confusing too, because it's new, because we are trying to put parts of ourselves in there too, in contrast to a scholarship that wants to be objective or linear. So your question also goes to methodologies. I integrate Indigenous feminist methodologies that do not want to sanitize or make things readily understandable. Like it's more about also emotions and you as a researcher. Well, how do you position yourself in regards to the research? So it connects to direct experience. My research is also collaborative because a lot of research in the area of anthropology, sociology, and I don't know, probably in the sciences too, is very extractive. And I mean, some people don't want to see that side of academia, but it is true. It is true. Like many researchers go places, you know, get the data, interviews, and they leave. So there are new ways of doing research with the people, with the Indigenous community in this case, and always not only thinking of your research objectives, but what benefit is going to be for them.
I see. Thank you so much for answering this question. So this podcast is intended to facilitate conversations between international students and international faculty for the wider Lafayette community to see. So if like any international students are incoming or new international students are going through culture shocks, do you have a personal experience that you would say was the biggest culture shock when you came here? I think for me, for example, and you mentioned this earlier, the idea of like race was not the same way. So I'm from Ethiopia. There are like several ethnicities. I come from a country with like 80 plus ethnicities, but race as a concept was not this integrated into the social life, because mainly because everybody is from the same race. And so seeing that, it was also a much later culture shock for me. I did not realize it immediately, but that was one of like the slower cultural shocks that I experienced. But if you had like any cultural shocks and like even silly things regarding to food, for example, maybe that you might want to share with the community.
The culture shock, yeah, race definitely is there. Like I mentioned, and like you said, is a slow process. Like, what's happening to me, right?
Yeah.
It's like you're busy surviving, working, studying, but you also know that something's happening to you. Language, I would say, in my case, because I used to be a tour guide in Peru. And I also learned German. And so my German, I think, was better at the time. So I was very confused with the language. People could not understand me. I remember dreaming of getting rid of my accent. Like, I remember dreaming in English, and I was like, oh my God, I'm so happy. I'm internalizing the language. So definitely language. Food, oh gosh. I think maybe you know that Peru is one of the gastronomy spots right now. So it is funny, whenever I'm with my family or Peruvian friends, everything we talk about is food. Like, we're eating and we're talking about our next meal or our next day. Like, it's, we are obsessed with food. So I think it's because food is home, right? The flavor, smell, it brings you back home, and that means you feel safe when everything else around you is telling you that you're not safe. What I would be more open now with the experience of being an immigrant or international student, to be more proactive in forming relationships with people from other parts of the world. Because now I know that I have more in common with people from anywhere in the world than with people from the US. Like, I don't know if you experience the same, but it's easier to establish connections with other immigrants. And sometimes it doesn't matter where they are from.
I see.
Yeah, absolutely. And you talking about that sense of community actually leads us to our other question too. And I completely agree about just like finding commonality, even like when it seems like, you know, you guys are from different places in the world, at the end of the day, you can still find that community. So I guess my question for you, Professor, would be, as an international student and, you know, as one who has an international background, how did you find that sense of community and what did that look like for you?
I always think of my life before academia. I think before academia, it was through my family. I got married, I had my son, and that filled much of the emptiness or the, you know, nostalgia I had for my family in Peru, who I didn't see for 7 years because I couldn't go. And it kept me busy too. Having a baby will definitely keep you busy. And I was going to school. Education to me was my community. And more than community was my refuge. I always think of bell hooks, who said that education transforms you. But to me, it made me feel I belong. Like, my ideas matter. What I think it's gonna be a contribution someday. So and I think that's why I'm a professor and a scholar, because I feel safe when I learn, when I challenge myself also to not only understand Peru, but that translation that we're always doing, right? When you are international or when you're an immigrant, you're always like between worlds. And finding that sweet spot for me is education.
Considering the fact that we are also on a college campus, education is like very important. Personally, I also find it to be the common ground, because I mean, we're on a college campus, but going to especially like humanities classes where you can speak up and your voice matters and you bring experience into the classroom is like a real event that we see. I think you touched up on this, why you went into academia, but this one is a bit of a speculative question. So the question is, if you were not a professor, what do you think you'd be doing?
Oh, I know though. I would dance. I love dancing. I love music. I used to sing in a mariachi in California. I'm taking voice lessons here. And one day when I retire, I see myself singing and dancing somewhere, maybe in Peru or here, but yeah, I wanted to be a singer when I was your age. And my dad said, that's not a real career. Bring me your degree and then you can do whatever you want. And I think he was right.
Yeah, that's actually the same conversation that I have with my dad as a film major, pursuing like the act of storytelling and a lot of the acting that I had and that I wanted to bring here on campus. But my dad and I were also like, oh, we got to think more practical. And so I'm also an econ major because of that sort of reason as well. So it's very nice to hear that as well. And mariachi too, like that hits with me too. So moving on to our next question, which is more about the international student community as a whole. If you had to give, you know, advice to us as international students, what would that be?
Do not be afraid of using your voice like you're doing it. Take space. Like I'm almost 50 and I'm learning that I'm gonna take space and make use of the technology resources. Like your major, probably your major is going to be the best major in the near future, because you know technology is taking over so much of our lives. But to bring authenticity into that is, I think, the strategy. Mm-hmm. Like anyone can produce with AI, you can produce anything, but how do you bring your authentic self or your community into that is the key to that. And AI, I don't think AI can do that.
Absolutely.
Maybe not
yet.
I'm like
we don't know, right? Yeah, that's the scary part. Yeah.
Yeah. And like I said before, reach out to other people. Reach out, because we have so much more in common than we think. And we are soon, I mean, Latinos, we're going to be the largest minority. And one day, who knows, I think maybe like a majority or a good percentage of the population. And what is happening right now is a reaction to that fear that this country is changing fast and is going to keep changing regardless of what they try to do to us. To stop that change.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you so much.
So we had these conversations about like race and in relation to your research. And again, since this is like an international student community, we tend to have these discussions about our culture, our race, and our lived experiences, which you mentioned are also becoming a big part in academia. So through your research and other works of community engagement, I assume that you facilitate a lot of these conversations about race and other similar factors, including lived experiences. So how does like the willingness to have these conversations look like on this campus? And what advice would you give to international students, for example, willing to facilitate those conversations, have those conversations in their daily lives about our lived experiences and differences?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's not always easy to do it. For example, in my classes right now, I'm teaching Spanish for heritage speakers, and that's students who have an advanced level of Spanish. So we can communicate, talk a lot. But my other class is intermediate Spanish. And how I'm always struggling, how do I bring this, all this knowledge, right? All these ideas I have. And I keep going back to media. For example, with the three of my classes, I'm gonna bring influencer, a Quechua young influencer from Cusco, whom I've been working with. And she's coming to the New York area, so I thought I have to bring her. I wish I could have organized something bigger, but I'm going to bring her to my classes and, you know, take advantage of that space and materialize the connections I already have with Indigenous women. And I see that as one way of contributing to the diversity on our campus. Other ways, maybe more personal, I think is usually it comes to the simple exchanges one-on-one. We cannot always have all these more collective spaces. Like, for example, I know there are a lot of Latino, Latina students or Latin American students, and there is not one organization. And I'm always thinking, I have to do something, but I'm also limited on my time. And I don't know if you're familiar with the tenure track process. Like it's so demanding, and you know, I have ideas, I have connections, but it takes a lot of work. So I think I'm gonna do it. So be patient with yourself. Use the micro interactions, micro moments with one-on-one student. I think officially this administration is trying to maintain at least in light of, you know, the cuts to DEI and outside political atmosphere against diversity. I think the administration is trying to maintain some of these spaces. But in classes, in clubs, and I know Lafayette is very active when it comes to that. So I would say do not also exhaust yourself, because we are good at that. We are good at overworking ourselves and then feeling drained. And that's not the goal either. In these times, we have to protect our joy. That is one of my philosophies now. I'm not going to let the news drain me. It upsets me. I have rage. but I'm also going to protect my spirit, because the struggle is for a long time.
Yeah, thank you very much for that. And I completely agree. And yeah. Elda, do you have any final thoughts?
Yeah, I was going to speak on the concept of college clubs and like taking advantage of clubs. I know that there are a lot of identity-based clubs on campus. I'm personally a member of the Lafayette African and Caribbean Students Association. I know that there is an active effort where we're trying to establish Ethiopian and Eritrean Students Association. I'm sure, Leo, you know some more, so you can say a bit more on that.
Yeah. I've been a part of HSL as well. I have a good friend of mine, she's the president, and she's been doing a lot of good advancements for the club, but I see it as well in my communities in the classroom as well. Film as a whole, I don't know if you are familiar with Nandinisa Khan as well. She's, you know, just a pioneer in a lot of this and pushing for a lot in the film community, but it also just translates over to the whole campus wide as well. So I think, and it's just we gotta really not take for granted all these sorts of interactions and communities, and as you said, all the micro communities, all the micro actions that we take with each other too. We can't take that for granted and just try to, you know, be looking out for. I feel like, as you know, as a Latino as well, I'm always seeing how, you know, our heritage is always kind of like something of cultivation, something of like helping each other out, always looking out for our family. And here in Lafayette as well, I feel like a lot of us find family in all these communities too. So something that we got to hold on to as well. So, yeah.
Yeah, in terms of, I agree with Leo, and in terms of facilitating these conversations as well, I think the micro interactions really bring out a lot of these ideas. For example, in my first year seminar, I remember, like, I don't intentionally mean to bring up my lived experiences, but then at some point it does come up, And at the end of the semester, the professor was like, I really appreciate your experiences. And there are always differences, I think, from my observations in classrooms. And when all these differences come together and we're able to interact in a facilitated environment, I think there can be a great exchange of ideas to be found in this.
Yeah, and I think art, media, things like that is definitely something that we gotta nurture as well. Whether you are an influencer, whether you are a musician, whether you know, you're a filmmaker or a writer, you know, you gotta get all these experiences of community, and you gotta take it from your own, you know, experiences. So that's something that I think is something that I've been trying to since freshman year, trying to promote the arts as well, because I think that's like, that is a lot of what a lot of people consider home as well, you know, like food is something, the arts is something as well. So
music.
Yeah, music. So with that being said, thank you so much, Professor, again, for giving us your time. We really enjoyed hearing about your stories.
I enjoy it so much, sharing and hearing the many connections we already have. And I wish you the best at the school. They take advantage of us. Reach out to your professors. Ask questions. I know it can be a little scary sometimes because academia is also very hierarchical. But we are here to serve you. We are here to help you and see you grow. And it is my students' joy and hope that keeps me going, for real. It is seeing how much you get transformed that I'm like, yeah, the world is going to be okay.
Yeah. All right. Thank you for joining the Global Expressions podcast. See you in the next episode.